around crowded spaces. Its infection has a direct relationship with how crowded places are, and as a result, it majorly affects the jobs that deal with crowded spaces, which is the service occupations. As a result, the effect of coronavirus has been mild on the production section. The 12th administration cannot hide its lack of attention to the production section behind the outbreak of coronavirus.
Mr. Davoudi is the IRNA agency's chief of news. He came to Press TV studios to share his journalist's fair view of the situation.
Mr. Rouhani's administrations have made achievements in the past 8 years, which I think are all valuable, both in terms of economics and politics. One is that after 2015, having a nuclear program was recognized as a right for Iran by other nations, which wasn't the case before. I think this is their biggest possible achievement, although they could make more progress too. But out of bad luck, a president took office in the US who eliminated all the achievements. Trump ruined all Rouhani's plans for the country's growth.
When the nuclear deal came into force in 2016, sanctions were lifted. But the economy didn't exactly pick up, as the deal didn't bring in Iran's expected foreign investment, which would have helped privatization and hence the greatly centralized economy. And then, with the US unilateral pullout, sanctions came gushing in, bringing with them a whole lot of new rubble along the way. Principalists have been mocking Rouhani's hope campaign, his attempts to revive the JCPOA via Vienna talks that started over 3 months ago. His response? He simply suggested that they be put on the spot about whether they want sanctions relief. To what extent would you say hiccups in Iran's economy are down to foreign policy and foreign trade?
The situation we're in is a project of not only our foreign policy, but a multitude of different issues. Speaking of foreign policy, I definitely believe that the world is like a village, and we can't barricade ourselves off of the rest of the world. We can't achieve any dynamic economy without interacting with the world and our neighbors. We need to expand our foreign relations. But on the other hand, issues such as mismanagement has had serious effects on the country's conditions. We need to focus our attention on issues that could generate added value for us and disregard others that don't.
When you have managers who are in favor of westernization, of course they'll be after expanding discrimination too, because it's one of the principles of a capitalist economic system. Giving out economic rent and causing injustice are the other characteristics of a capitalist economy. The aim of an Islamic economy is promoting justice. But the capitalists seek growth by any means, no matter if a majority of people is being crushed under pressure while a few prosper. Unfortunately, Rouhani's administration tied the economy to the West. He wanted to implement a Western capitalist economy, and that's why we failed. They tied the economy to the JCPOA and the FATF.
It was on the 8th of May 2018 that the US pulled out, with sanctions ensuing in a month, which set out to target Iranian purchases of US dollars, metal trading, coal, industrial software, and Iran's auto sector. Though the toughest measures targeting oil exports were not to take effect for another 4 months. US companies don't do much business with Iran, but Washington has the ability to block European and Asian firms from trading here.
Well, both sanctions and the COVID pandemic affected the economy, but we suffered the most damage from Rouhani's administration's lack of insight, which stemmed from trusting the US and Europe. After the US withdrew from the JCPOA, the administration continued its compliance with the deal, arguing that everyone else is still a party to it. This is why the Europeans have $1,400 billion worth of economic ties with the US, compared to $20 billion with Iran. Obviously, they wouldn't abandon the $1,400 billion for our $20 billion.
The Iranian economy has been adapted to sanctions of different strengths since the revolution of 1979, and so it is industrially moderately independent. But still, it is beset by high unemployment, a real currency that took a deep dip towards the end of President Ahmadinejad's term and has now taken a plunge, and It has oil exports that have gone down from under 2.5 million barrels per day to unknown lows. Now it's become better, of course. But still, this forced the country to print money without backup, and it sent the country into high inflation. Principalists were genuinely vindicated when the U.S. binned the deal after Iran's compliance in paralyzing its nuclear program and rendering the country vulnerable to outsiders coming in as nuclear observers. But they also realized the importance of reviving the economy and that sanctions relief would be a quick step in that direction. It will be Rouhani's tragedy if they get to revive the deal he made. He has just days left in office.
If I want to mention some achievements of Mr. Rouhani's administration, we need to go back to 2015, a year that tens of billions of dollars of Iran's frozen assets were released, a year when $10 billion of Iran's frozen oil sale revenue were released by Italy, India, and the UK, a year that Eni, Shell, and Total came back to our oil industry. Car manufacturers like Volkswagen, Citroën, Peugeot, Renault, and Mercedes came back to Iran to build their commercial products. The year we placed orders for 230 Airbus, Boeing, and ATR airliners. If we remember that year, we would realize the political and economic managers of Mr. Rouhani had laid the groundwork very well.
Well, the Americans didn't provide any guarantee to lift the sanctions in practice and stay committed to their promises. Foreign Minister Zarif said the signature of the then U.S. Secretary of State, Mr. Kerry, is a guarantee. While it couldn't have been, the signature of the U.S. President or even the Congress aren't considered a guarantee because they can simply back out of it. Mr. Trump took office and nullified Mr. Obama's signatures. President Biden also reversed some of Trump's orders. The Congress may pass a bill, but can pass anything else afterwards. The guarantee is valid when things go step by step, but because the administration wanted to show goodwill, it did whatever they wanted in advance. In such circumstances, why would they honor their commitments?
Here's a still more or less current price list of 2020 that may make Rouhani look like the worst president ever. But he didn't inherit a bed of roses and hasn't been readily supported with his foreign policy and trade projects. A US dollar equals about 250,000 rials. A standard gold coin would be 110 million rials. The average price of property is 200 million rials per square meter, and it's 30,000 rials per liter for gasoline. To go slightly back, Iran's economy contracted by more than 6% in both 2018 and 2019, according to IMF. That's the International Monetary Fund. It's not just sanctions. Economic ills have been exacerbated also by the coronavirus pandemic. To put figures into a context of Iran's contemporary history, here's a chart showing the rise and fall of inflation during the 5th to 12th presidencies. From a low of under 15% shortly after the Iraq-Iran war during protectionist Rafsanjani's first term as president, the inflation rose to its highest ever in his second term. That's 49%. That was classed as a reason for a reformist getting the next vote. Khatami was the name, and inflation kept at a low during his two terms, which ended with inflation at under 20%. Next came the controversial principalist Ahmadinejad, whose presidency experienced some turmoil. As you see, inflation made some sharp bounces up and down. His first term averaged at 16.5%, dropped to around 10% towards the end, then spiked to about 35% as his second term was ending in 2013. To bridge the gap between reformist and principalist, moderate Rouhani won the next presidency. Looking at the chart, it's as though the JCPOA president dragged inflation down with all his might to a real low of under 10% in 2016, a year before term end. That's the second time in Iran's post-revolutionary history that inflation has dropped that much. Then, with the nuclear deal having fizzled out, inflation shot up to over 40%, that's 42% actually, towards the end of Rouhani's second term in office. And now it's at 45%. short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Review of figures. Let's do a quick media review to see what other news outlets have to say. Here it is in words. Iran Focus mentions some capacities Iran readily had, economic capacities, which it has lost. Destroyed capacities of Iran's economy. In recent decades, Iran's economy has moved away from development. Political tensions and the escalation of sanctions, along with mismanagement and inefficiency of managers in various governments, have exacerbated the issue and prevented the Iranian economy from achieving growth and development, and led to the spread of poverty as much as possible. Today, Iran doesn't have stable exports and imports from neighboring countries and the world, and in trade agreements, it has not defined a reciprocal flow for any of the countries and international unions. Even now, the crushing budget deficit has flattened the Rouhani government, so higher costs mean higher inflation and more severe economic and social crises. Rouhani's term is coming to an end. Now it is up to the new government to try and solve these issues after taking office in a very near future. Tasnim talks of how Rouhani will be handing over the job to Raisi for a gentle transition. Administration gives successor realistic prospect of Iran's economy. Rouhani, the outgoing president of Iran, said his administration is offering a general outlook of the country's economy to its successor and will share experiences with the next administration's officials. Speaking at a meeting at the Economic Coordination Headquarters, President Hassan Rouhani said his administration has made arrangements for the transition of power with a national outlook and tries to realistically outline the country's macroeconomic plans for the next administration. Pointing to his cabinet's efforts to give transparent reports about its activities over the past 8 years, Rouhani said the people should be informed of the problems that the administration has dealt with and of the measures it has taken to nullify the sanctions and counter the economic war. The Financial Tribune gets a little more technical. Monthly PMI for overall economy drops by 4.7%. The overall purchasing managers index, known by its Farsi acronym Shahmeh, for Iran's overall economy, dropped in the third month of the current Iranian year, May 22 to June 21st, after emerging in the second month from a steep decline of the first fiscal month, starting March the 21st. The overall PMI for Iran's economy settled at 51.27 in the month ending June the 21st, from 53.84 in the month ending May the 21st, indicating a 2.57-point or 4.7% decline. A report by the Statistics and Economic Analysis Center of the Iran Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, the sponsor and coordinator of the survey, says the reading of the index suggests that the economy is still in expansion mode. However, economic players are concerned about power outages and shortage of raw materials. Indices show economic expansion when compared with the previous month. A PMI reading of under 50 indicates contraction, and a reading of 50 implies no change. So if you've got 51.27, that's an expansion. That would be it for this segment, but do stay with us. Iran being a petropower by nature, whatever its present circumstance, it calls for a quick look at its oil and gas export revenues during the 5th to 11th presidential terms. Looking at the chart, President Rafsanjani saw oil and gas revenues rise from around $25 billion to under $40 billion in his second year in office. That's in 1990. As the second term came to an end, so did energy revenues drop to around 20 billion. With Khatami, they first dropped further, but then peaked to around 30 billion and dropped a little again. As a sign of success, revenues spiked to a high of $55 billion and more to mark the end of Khatami's presidency. Come Ahmadinejad, revenues rose and fell, as with inflation in his era. It rose to 90 billion, then fell to around 70 billion, as his first term ended in 2009. His second term saw revenue spike to around $110 billion, then crash down to around 55 billion, as he left his office behind. The lowering trend went on to about $30 billion in 2015 when Rouhani was in office. After the JCPOA of 2015 and 16, things picked up. Then again, they deflated with the U.S. pullout and renewed sanctions during Rouhani's second term in office. Economic growth here depends mainly on oil revenues, which explains why the growth rate has been negative in recent years since sanctions renewal. Traditionally, oil revenues make up for more than 50% of Iran's budget. Here's how the Statistical Center of Iran sees economic growth panning over presidencies. The fifth government, that's Hashemi Rafsanjani's first term in office, saw a rise in economic growth to under 15% in 1989. But then it went downhill to rise moderately in 1996 and dropped to zero by the end of his second term. Come Khatami, with every fall came a rise. His highest point was about 7.5% growth in 2002. Ahmadinejad followed, starting with a gentle growth, which at its highest in 8 years hit around 7%, and after some bouncing, plunged to the lowest level in all 8 presidencies, to about minus 5 at a point. With Rouhani, growth was significant. It picked up and up to about 7% and took one plunge only in his unfortunate second term to about minus 2%.
Of course, there are criticisms against the administration's performance. I think insufficient work was done in the housing sector. That's why we're dealing with a very bad situation there. But speaking of the current administration's non-JCPOA-related achievements, I need to point out the decision to make pensions equal. That really helped the pensioners, and I hope the draft bill is enacted so that the change would be made permanent. The other achievement was in managing financial and credit institutions. If you can remember, we had problems with them a few years ago. But you haven't been hearing of a financial institution embezzling or stealing people's money for a few years now.
As for the new Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, he centralized his campaign on fixing the economy, as a matter of fact. But he bluntly said no to the notion of getting into direct talks with his American counterpart in the early days post-election. He did give a nod to pursuing ongoing talks, however. It is to be seen if his style will work any better than other principalists who have dominated the system since parliamentary elections in February 2020. Principalists behind him appear to have recognized the potential contribution of sanctions relief to his public standing, if not to the economy. Earlier, with Rouhani at full throttle, the new parliament wasted no time in passing a bill demanding strict sanction relief deadlines for the U.S. so that Iran would itself recommit to the deal. President Rouhani was furious, saying of his top nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi at the Vienna talks, he could finalize the deal as soon as today, referring to Parliament's postponement late last year. To the U.S., MPs' demands were impossible to meet. Although the MPs themselves largely felt justified for said reasons and because they were incensed at what they called Rouhani's putting all his eggs into one basket, rather than depending also on China and regional countries for trade.
Honestly, the JCPOA was a big deal, but speaking of the weaknesses of Rouhani's achievements in the past 8 years, I think we should admit that some issues could have been managed better. But to that end, the executive branch was left alone, while other branches of the administration should have helped it. After the Saudi Arabian embassy was stormed, we should have reacted better and tried to normalize our relations with Arab states in the Persian Gulf. We also should have done more with relations to our ties with China and Russia.
We said economic woes don't depend wholly on foreign policy. Domestic mismanagement and corruption are no less to blame. But the government is not alone in deserving blame there either. It is but one branch of more than three in this country. Regarding the government's own share of blame, here's one example.
Corruption was rampant in Mr. Rouhani's administration, from his brother to the brother of his first vice president, who are now in jail. But one of Mr. Raisi's very positive characteristics is that he's a very healthy individual and will try to choose managers who are honest. He responds very harshly to any corruption. Mr. Rouhani would increase the salaries amid the economic problems, including that of the managers, which were not proportionate to the raise ordinary people would receive.
Indeed, Iran faced problems even between 2015 and 2018, when sanctions were lifted and the administration received billions of dollars in previously frozen assets. Critics blame the administration for wasting resources, but most of the wastage was made without the administration's intervention. As an example, when foreign economic pressures affected the forex market, the Rouhani administration gave dollars at preferential rates up to four times cheaper than market rates to insiders. This was for them to import essential commodities. According to critics, many of the insiders who received the cheap dollars never returned the profits or even the original sums. That's presuming they didn't bring in imports. Mr. Qadiri is against the cheap dollars to begin with.
There were some wrong policies. For example, the dollar must be sold at a single rate. But the administration sold it at 4,200 tumans, which is one-fifth of its true price. Well, anyone who received the currency at that rate could make a 500% profit off of it. These are the wrong policies that we witnessed during other administrations too. The currency rates need to be real. The administration should determine its price on the stock market and not in meetings, so it can change it however it wants every single day.
Rouhani's administration made the least efforts to implement principles of resistance economy, while, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution said, it isn't a new phenomenon. The Westerners, the Americans, Europeans, British and French have been supporting their domestic production for 300 years, which is a main principle of resistance economy. They took that formula but are dictating privatization and abandoning domestic production to us.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do join us again at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's going to be on. Till then, bye.
Nairobi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Nairobi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Nairobi English Radio.
The limelight.
Revision of mask guidelines comes amid a surge in COVID cases as Delta variant in the U.S. becomes more prevalent, says Martin Pengley, reporter, in an article published under the heading CDC advises vaccinated people to wear masks indoors in Delta surge areas. Stay tuned for more. The U.S. top health agency revised its mask guidance recently and now recommends fully vaccinated Americans wear masks indoors in certain places. In a shift from its earlier guidance issued on May 13th, which said vaccinated individuals did not need to wear masks in most indoor settings, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, now advises Americans to wear a mask in public indoor settings with substantial and high transmission. This comes amid a surge in COVID cases as the highly contagious Delta variant has become more prevalent. The recent updated guidelines come 2 months after the CDC revised its mask guidance for vaccinated people. The guidance, which still called for wearing masks in crowded indoor settings like buses, planes, hospitals, prisoners, and homeless shelters, had cleared the way for reopening workplaces and other venues. The CDC now recommends that fully vaccinated people living with vulnerable household members, such as those who are immunocompromised and children, wear masks in indoor public spaces. In addition, the agency recommended everyone in K-12 schools wear masks, including teachers, staff, students, and visitors, regardless of vaccination status, said the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, in a press briefing recently. In recent days, I have seen new scientific data from recent outbreak investigations showing that the Delta variant behaves uniquely differently from past strains of the virus that caused COVID-19, Walensky said, referring to scientists' discovery of the Delta strain shedding as actively in breakthrough infections as it does in unvaccinated individuals, despite the rarity of breakthrough cases. For months, COVID cases, deaths, and hospitalizations were falling steadily, but the highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus has fueled steep rises in case numbers, particularly among unvaccinated Americans and amid struggles with disinformation and resistance, particularly on the political right. Nobody wants to go backward, but you have to deal with the facts on the ground. And the facts on the ground are that it's a pretty scary time, and there are a lot of vulnerable people, Robert Watcher, chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, told the Washington Post. I think the biggest thing we got wrong was not anticipating that 30% of the country would choose not to be vaccinated. In recent weeks, a growing number of cities and towns across the U.S. have restored indoor masking rules. St. Louis, Savannah, Georgia, and Provincetown, Massachusetts are among the places that reimposed mask mandates this month. More than 162.7 million Americans are vaccinated, or 49% of the population, according to the CDC. California and New York announced recently that they would require all government employees to get the coronavirus vaccine or face weekly COVID-19 testing. And the Department of Veterans Affairs became the first major federal agency to require healthcare workers to receive the shot. In New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that all municipal workers, including teachers and police officers, will be required to get vaccinated by mid-September or face weekly COVID-19 testing, making the city one of the largest employers in the U.S. to take such an action. Let's be clear about why this is so important. This is about the recovery, de Blasio said. California said it will similarly require proof of vaccination or weekly testing for all state workers and healthcare employees starting next month. the Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzieh Hashemi. Pegasus, an Israeli spy work, the malware for mobile phones, has been spying on anyone from regular citizens to heads of states and journalists. The audio and video of one's phone can be turned on without the owner knowing it. And everything can be accessed, from old messages to notes on your phone, contacts. Nothing is safe. How dangerous is this? And what can be done to stop it? We will be taking a look at all of this on the Spotlight.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula O'Dean, and Anas al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is, you know, something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus. Yet number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates.
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, author and researcher Daniel Genja out of Barcelona, and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles. Thank you both for being with us. Well, I'm going to start this off in Barcelona. And Daniel, we have heard for years that smartphones can listen in and even see its owners without them knowing. Tell me what is different about this Pegasus spyware and what makes it so much more dangerous.
The Pegasus spyware is able to be installed on the phone without the owner doing anything. It can be installed remotely without the owner having any idea that it actually is on their phone. It can access their messages, it can access their camera, their microphone, and is basically able to have full control over all the content on their phone, which makes it very dangerous. Now, the issue with Pegasus had also been raised previously. This is it is not new that what we know about the software. What is new now is, of course, the extent of how many people individually in higher positions have been targeted, which of course creates a completely new reality of a very global surveillance that is being the record has its source in a Zionist entity where it has been, where this software has been developed with the backing of the Zionist regime directly.
Let me go over to Ramiro. Daniel just said something about the Zionist entity, and I want to pick up on that as far as this being an Israeli company and the danger of that in general, because we know that it is a regime that does not abide by any type of international law at all. Ramiro, your take on that side of it.
That's exactly right. I think the Pegasus software is extremely dangerous. It is part and parcel of the Zionist method of control using intelligence abroad. The founders of the quote-unquote State of Israel understood the importance of controlling key aspects of infrastructure and trade, controlling the key trade routes of society, hence why occupied Palestine, or the State of Israel, is where it is today, because it sits at the key intersections of infrastructure in the Middle East. Now, applying that same logic to the 21st century, what are the key infrastructure points? The internet, WhatsApp, Google, Facebook. These are the points of infrastructure that are used all over the world daily by every single person. I don't know a single person who doesn't have a smartphone, who doesn't have these apps. And so now we can consider these applications, these devices, as key infrastructure. And yet, once again, the Zionists have taken control of this key infrastructure, control the information that flows in and out, and see and monitor anybody who's in any way speaking out against their client governments. In Latin America, for example, one of the more lesser reported stories is that the Israeli government has been selling Pegasus, the Zionists have been selling Pegasus to the governments of Mexico, Honduras, and Colombia, three of which are key drug trading countries that are involved in the drug trade in the United States. And this software has been used to monitor, track, and assassinate activists, journalists who have spoken out against the crimes of the Mexican government, the Honduran government, the Colombian government, in collaboration with Mossad, with the IDF, with Israeli intelligence. So this is something that affects the entire world, and it affects key infrastructure because everyone uses smartphone technology. And I think it's, again, part and parcel of the Zionist strategy of controlling the key points of infrastructure to make sure that nobody speaks out against their allies.
Daniel, your take on what Ramira just said about as far as being selling this to certain governments. I want to look at the way that this malware can be used to control dissent, control whether we're talking about journalists, activists, and even sometimes heads of states. As we talked about earlier, that with this spyware, everything is accessible, which of course means very private information that could lead to blackmail.
It's dangerous in so many ways, especially because it is not only a tool that was developed by the Zionists, was developed by people who have ties to the Zionist regime and was approved by it. It was also promoted by the Zionist regime to be sold to different regimes, but also it is being sold, it is disseminated and used in different ways. And even in, if I remember correctly, in 2018, there was an article in the Zionist newspaper that there was an investigative report on how many countries and how many regimes have been using this particular software to spy, but not only to spy, on journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, academics, but also to coerce and threaten and blackmail people or to persecute minorities. So this can effectively, of course, lead to an increase of state violence and can have drastic implications for individuals and for population groups, which is what makes it dangerous on so many levels. But of course, it is part and parcel of the Zionist strategy, because as much of other technologies and mechanisms that the Zionist regime is selling globally, it has consolidated itself globally as a force for the creation of methods of population containment and control that had been practiced and tested on Palestinians for at least the last 73 years. So much of the surveillance is tested in Palestine, and in many ways, Pegasus is just one of the examples of the transnationalization of the violence against Palestinians, where Israel is using Palestinians and developing all sorts of methods that will help oppress people elsewhere and coerce people in key positions to coerce them into making decisions, which gives, again, the Zionist regime even much more power, potentially.
I mean, Romero, I mean, would you say that this cyber surveillance is a new weapon? Obviously, that is quite dangerous. And what needs to be done in order to control it, just as we have other weapons that there are various laws with it. What do you think about that? What can be done?
Cyber surveillance is definitely a weapon, not only because it serves to monitor your actions, to make sure that you stay in line, to make sure that you don't criticize Israel, to make sure that you don't criticize the U.S., the Western countries, but it also serves as a weapon, a mass weapon of distraction. Here in the United States, where I'm speaking to you now from, every day there are new applications, methods, devices, content designed to distract and miseducate the population, to keep people misinformed, to not care about what's going on around the world. And I think that this cyber surveillance, it plays a role as well when we're talking about predictive behavior and data. Based on the words that you type on your phone, based on the words that you say in conversations with people, the big tech companies, which are 100% in collaboration with the Zionist Entity of Israel, they use that data to predict your behavior and also to influence your behavior, to make it seem as if you want something that you really don't, to put content in your face and to want a desired outcome. And this is also used in the political sphere as well, where we see social media surveillance being used to promote regime change efforts in Cuba, to promote regime change efforts in the Middle East and all over the world. And so I think that cyber surveillance and spying and hacking is a huge threat, not only in terms of collecting data and keeping people in a low vibrational state of distraction, but also in terms of making you want something that you really didn't want. And I think in terms of correcting this, I think it really comes down to values. It really comes down to having progressive anti-imperialist governments realign the values of a society. I think Iran is doing a great job at that. I think countries like Nicaragua, Venezuela are doing a great job of that as well, where they're creating their own independent media companies, their own smartphone technology, their own devices that are free from some of the filth that we see in the Western societies, free from the hacking. And so I think it's really up to the anti-imperialist countries like Iran, like Russia, like China, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, to develop independent technologies and infrastructure so that they can't get to our technologies to begin with, to create things that aren't designed to distract us and keep us in a low state. Okay. And so I think that's it.
Well, what about that, Daniel? He just said about the, which I like, the weapons of mass distraction. And he talked about the anti-imperialist front. But as you know, the anti-imperialist front is continually under pressure, whether we're talking about economic sanctions or we're talking about in the media war, the soft war. And on the other hand, so when you're still using some of their platforms, as we saw with Press TV basically being shut down and taken off of .com, so where do we go with this? On the one hand, the pressure is on economically. On the other hand, if we use their platforms or use their smartphones, now we see the situation with actually the Israeli regime being in control of most of it.
Rather a dilemma, and I agree that there need to be new ways to be found in order for anti-imperialist factions to develop different kinds of, maybe through a collaboration of alternative media. I mean, Press TV has, this example you mentioned, when Press TV's domain was bought, Press TV managed very swiftly to use a different domain and still to continue its program without any major interruption, which showed that even those threats or direct forms of intimidation coming from the U.S. regime have been able to, Press TV was able to circumvent them. But of course, the danger is there. And effectively, there would need to be different ways to find alternative platforms that can be used. But also, I agree with what the other guest said. It's, of course, also a question of values, because as long as there is this imperialist structure and as long as the Zionist entity exists, we will be faced with such challenges, because effectively even this cyber spying is just a digitalized form of different forms of spying that the Zionist entity has been employing for so many years, such as the conventional spying, where they would spy and conduct targeted assassinations against people. And these days, these things take place rather in online spaces, but there needs, of course, to be a continuous effort from within the resistance axis and from the resistance to counter these efforts, and of course to remain aware of them.
Well, Ramiro, why aren't we seeing a stronger reaction from Western governments? Because also some of them have been targeted. We saw that Emmanuel Macron of France, of course, was one of those that was targeted. And I mean, we have seen the reports coming out about Saudi Arabia and UAE, these authoritarian countries like this, using it to silence dissent. So these countries that at least try to say that they support human rights, some of these Western governments, why aren't we even hearing anything coming out of, for example, Washington or London in condemning this spyware?
I think Washington and London will never condemn any of the crimes of Israel and the Zionist entity, because it falls in line exactly with their foreign policy goals. When we're talking about the victims of these cyber attacks in the Middle East, we have, you know, targeting against Palestinians, against people in Yemen, against people in Afghanistan, Iran, and then in Latin America as well, you know, you have journalists, activists, academics in Mexico, Colombia, Honduras, countries that are neo-colonies of U.S. imperialism. All of that benefits the interests of Wall Street and the London Stock Exchange. And this is the new level and the new frontier of the war in the 21st century. We're no longer in the era of frontline soldiers and infantry combating each other. We're in a communicational war, a digital war of data, where if you have more data and information from your enemy, you can control them more. You can even predict their behavior. The technology with AI and algorithms is so advanced that you can manipulate a whole society into believing something that is not true. And so I think the reason why the Western countries will never call out Israel is because they're in fact collaborating with Israel to use this technology against their enemies, against their oppressors. And they're using this as a way to enter the next frontier of imperialism in the 21st century. And it's something that's very scary. And that's why I'm very proud of countries like Iran and Russia and China and others in the anti-imperialist bloc that are developing independent technology, because the second you agree to use their infrastructure, their technology, their apps, you're making yourself vulnerable to their exploitation, to them surveilling you if you speak out against them. And so it's so important for us to develop the next level of defense, a frontier, our own technologies, our own applications. And I think that's what it's going to take.
Daniel, what do you think about as for the possibility of a grassroots global movement in trying to get this type of spyware to be banned or to be deemed illegal? The possibility of that side of things?
As long as governments are continuing to use the spyware, I don't see much probability of that. Of course, now there is an awareness of the spyware, but still, like, even in the Western media, it hasn't been the Israeli role in it hasn't been as highlighted as much as it could have, and it has continued to be used by governments that, as you said, at least pretend that they are interested in human rights. While at the same time, of course, it also serves the Zionist regime to connect with its newfound allies. It has sold the software to the regimes in Saudi and Bahrain and UAE and so on, who don't even pretend that they care about human rights. So effectively, I do not think that could lead to the software being banned. And even if the Zionist regime has been promoting itself as a technological hub, as a very advanced digitalized entity, so I wouldn't be surprised if they have other software, so if they're already developing other things that they can use to continue spying on. And as long as they have Palestine as a testing ground, as a laboratory, where they are abusing Palestinians to develop all sorts of technologies, I do not see that there is a potential end to that coming from even from grassroots, as long as it's in the Western imperialist framework.
Well, what about that, Ramiro? Daniel just talked about the Zionist regime and how it, even with the spyware, they're using it to try to promote themselves, like they are above the rest. We know they use, from a military perspective, they use a lot of propaganda to say that they're the strongest and the most moral And now in dealing with technology, it's as if they want to say, we are superior, we are above the rest, and sort of an intimidation factor. What can be done about this? And what do you think about resistance media and the role of basically educating people to what's going on? Your take on what needs to be done on that side of things.
I think that's such a great point. One of the talking points of the Zionists is that Israel is a free, is paradise. You can do whatever you want. They boast about engaging in behavior, decadent behavior, in behavior that's immoral and behavior that is against traditional values. And Israel posits itself as a land of high-tech freedom, of unlimited access to whatever you want. And even within the internet realm, we also see the same thing happening with a lot of the adult content that a lot of Israeli companies have been supporting in the United States and the Western Hemisphere, that they're strongly connected to that. And it's something that is really hard for us in my generation, especially as a millennial, to really understand, because when they compare themselves to more traditional countries, Islamic countries that are preserving morals and values, that are not engaging in this online behavior, they make it seem as if they're better. And that's part of the chauvinism and the arrogance of Israel. They say that they're free, they're advanced, they're in the future, but they make a false equation of being advanced and high tech with being decadent, with being lewd, with being all sorts of kind of things. And I think it's important for a new culture to emerge online that is not based on lewd adult content, that is not based on some of the arrogance, on the decadence that we see on social media and on media platforms in general that highlight gross wealth and fame and luxury cars. We have to create a new culture and a new technology based around families, based around traditional living, based around anti-imperialism, preserving our way of life aside from the empire. And okay. I think that this is the only way out.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this program. Author and researcher Danielle Jedrick out of Barcelona, and journalist and commentator